In the 2000s, London became home to the Russian super rich. Vast wealth was stripped from Russia by the oligarchs and flaunted in London through grandiose properties, ferocious legal disputes, private jets, mega yachts, and ubiquitous bodyguards. Russian oligarchs made colossal fortunes after the collapse of communism, and London was the destination of choice to spend and protect their wealth. But the shocking killing of ex-KGB man Alexander Litvinenko in London with a radioactive element, polonium, and of Stephen Curtis, the lawyer to many of Britain's richest Russians, sent shockwaves through the Russian community in London. Today I'm speaking with Mark Hollingsworth about how Russia's wealth was harvested and brought to London, and how the UK's institutions and legal infrastructure facilitated the laundering of these vast fortunes, many of dubious provenance. Welcome to Silicon Curtain. All our content is also available on popular podcast platforms like Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Please like and subscribe to help new people find our fantastic speakers. And of course, if you enjoy the content, consider supporting us by becoming a patron. We'll be adding exclusive content there, such as chats and FAQs and extended conversations with our amazing guests. Mark Hollingsworth is an investigative journalist and author of 10 books, notably Londongrad, From Russian with Cash, The Inside Story of the Oligarchs, published in 2010. He has also written biographies of Mark Thatcher and Tim Bell and acclaimed studies on MI5 and the Saudi royal family. He started his career working for Granada TV's award-winning World in Action program and now contributes regularly to The Times, Mail on Sunday, The Guardian, and The Sunday Times. His most recent articles about Russia are published in The Spectator, and he is currently writing a history of the KGB. And I hope in a future discussion to unpack that topic with him as well. So Mark, I'm delighted to welcome you to the channel.
Pleasure to be with you.
And hopefully that sort of biography was accurate. I do actually also remember World in Action. I am old enough to recall watching that. So let's start with Londongrad. You know, what exactly is it? Because I think you were one of the first people to coin this term and to define what it means.
Well, the term Londongrad is a fusion of obviously London and the word grad, Stalingrad, Leningrad, and it's basically a term to describe the merger, effectively, of Russian oligarchs moving to London and parking their money, hiding their money in London, primarily through London property and an area of Surrey as well, where they like to buy mansions, but also in banks, investments, companies, and a whole range of assets, where they feel London in the 2000s was the safest place to protect their wealth, because in Russia, there's no rule of law. And the oligarchs who made their billions in the 1990s when Yeltsin was president always were very scared and nervous about their wealth being expropriated or confiscated if they did not make the right political connections, or for whatever reason, the Kremlin, the Russian state, would effectively, in effect, nationalize their assets. So they needed a place to hide their money, and London was the perfect choice.
And that's a pervading theme, isn't it? The idea of theft and the paranoia that the money you've accumulated, you know, whether it's through out-and-out theft or whether it's through luck or being the right place at the right time or having the right contact, there is this pervading sense of perhaps unfairness, which the oligarchs themselves understand. I think they also understand that if you have acquired your wealth extremely rapidly and sometimes through dubious methods, well, what is there stopping somebody else stealing it back off you?
Yes, I mean, there's an old Russian saying, which is never ask about the first million. And, you know, but I think the point about the Russian oligarchs, particularly even in the 90s, is that you have to be careful not to classify, categorize all of them in the same way. And there's a whole range of the way they made their money. Some was very corrupt, but others was actually just entrepreneurial, opportunistic, taking advantage, political manipulation. Some of it was not illegal, some of it certainly was corrupt, and bribing Yeltsin to ensure that they got the best deal when they bought very valuable state assets. So the point about the 90s under Yeltsin is that actually there wasn't necessarily a law that prevented, that prohibited the accumulation of very, very valuable state assets through privatization. And even lawyers can check on this, but there wasn't necessarily laws in place which made it illegal to make huge amounts of money very quickly in dubious circumstances. So when you ask the oligarchs about how they made their money in the 90s, they say, well, we didn't break any laws. The problem was there wasn't really laws to be broken. So I think the point is that there is a huge range of oligarch categories, as it were. I don't want to get too much into the detail of it, but I think the main overall point, the big picture, is that, you know, Russia was virtually bankrupt, but in 1998, and a small group of Russian billionaires and oligarchs acquired the vast majority of the wealth of Russia, and they didn't invest it back in Russia. They didn't give it to charities. They didn't invest in helping the Russian people. And this money belonged to the Russian people because it had been part of the Russian state. So the real crime for me is not so much how they made the money, although that's very dubious. The real crime is what they did with it. And what they did was that they took it out of the country, and they laundered it, hid it through a complex labyrinth of offshore companies and offshore trusts and banks and companies, and they hid it and they moved it out of Russia, and it ended up in London and in the south of France and in Switzerland and various countries. And the people, the victims of this, the people who suffered, were the Russian people. Because the contrast the between the very rich in Russia and basically the majority of the Russian people is huge. So it's the Russian people who have suffered as much as anything else from this.
And that's a really interesting concept, isn't it? Because without sort of going into the whole bestiary of the different kinds of oligarchs and where they got their money, even someone like Khodorkovsky, you perhaps shouldn't look too hard, as you say, at the first million and how they got going, even though Khodorkovsky then moved into really talking much more about transparency and Western standards of probity in his organization. That's one of the reasons why he was, of course, imprisoned and hounded out of Russia. But what is fascinating, I think, about it, isn't it, is that many, many of these oligarchs, they may have invested some of their money back in, but, you know, often it's extraction industries, isn't it? It's hydrocarbons, minerals, etc. It's not necessarily going back into manufacturing or industries that are going to sort of accumulate wealth within Russia and develop the economy. There are a few notable exceptions. And someone like Chicharkin, who I guess comes into the sort of oligarch category, is been an oppositionist in London for a long time. But rather than gaining from a state industry, you know, he created his business pretty much from scratch. It's mobile phones. It's a brand new industry. You're not sort of cannibalizing the wealth of the country. You're building something new. Do you think there's a defining characteristic of how oligarchs earn their money, not earn, wrong word, how oligarchs obtain their money, and their then subsequent behaviors and what they spent it on?
Yeah, there's a clear distinction between Russian oligarchs and wealthy Russians. Just because you're a wealthy Russian doesn't make you an oligarch. And I've just written, for example, I've just written an article for The Spectator about the sanctions against Russian oligarchs and about Russians based on the war in Ukraine. And I point out that actually a lot of the wealthy Russians who have been sanctioned are not necessarily oligarchs. They're not even close to Putin. They're not even supporting the Russian state, you know, and they're just, quite frankly, Russian entrepreneurs and wealthy Russians. But so there's a level of ignorance by the British government and the American government about Russian oligarch money. And as you've said, there's a clear distinction between the big Russian billionaire oligarchs, mainly of the 90s, who basically manipulated and ripped off the Russian state, mainly in oil and gas and aluminium and natural resources. And the entrepreneurial Russians, Chichvarkin is a very good example, but basically had nothing to do with Putin, no state contracts, no cozy deals with the Kremlin, and built up their own business and ended up in opposition, and then moved to London. So I think we have to be very careful and very clear about who the Russian, you know, the real Russian oligarchs are, you know, the people who ripped off the Russian state, and the greedy, selfish, manipulative Russian oligarchs, and a whole group of other wealthy Russian businessmen who are not like that.
And it's an interesting connection, isn't it? Because you say that, you know, one classification will probably have limited interaction with the state. Of course, you can't have no interaction, because if the state wants to exert influence over you, there are a myriad of ways it can do that. But generally speaking, you know, your fortune isn't tied to state contracts or connections within the state. And yet, a large number of oligarchs, that's not true, is it? I mean, essentially, if you've gained your fortune, you may have only been able to do that through these connections, or if that wasn't the case, then you retain your fortune by keeping these connections. And something interesting that Oliver, who I spoke to last week, pointed out, he said that where the British government went wrong, where we all went wrong, was to underestimate the closeness of connections between many of the oligarchs abroad, especially in London, and with the Kremlin, FSB, and other institutions that make up the so-called Silver Key.
Yes, I mean, that's true. And even if your wealth is not based on a specific privatization or contracts with the state, you still have to have a close relationship with the Kremlin, because, you know, it's Russia today is a form of basically a authoritarian capitalist economy. It's basically state capitalism, whereby you have a free market economy ostensibly, but in reality, that free market and those companies are only operate at the largesse of the Kremlin and a small number of officials around Putin, who are nearly all ex-KGB, ex-FSB, and they really control ultimately the wealth, particularly of Gazprom, Rosneft, and those companies, which in reality are, they're not, maybe not state owned, but they allies with the state. And if they decide that you should be subject to a big tax investigation or a criminal investigation or any kind of regulatory inquiry, it just happens. I mean, for me, the number one problem with Russia and in any country where there's problems with corruption or the economy or poverty is the rule of law. And it just is, for me, that is the most important thing, because you cannot, if you don't have an objective judiciary, and if you have a legal system that is arbitrary and politicized and corrupt, you can't enforce contracts. You can't make sure that business is done in a fair and equitable way. And I think that is the major problem. So that the state, the Kremlin basically, and the small elite around Putin, they have so much power to basically take over your business. The obvious example is Khodorkovsky, who was funding opposition groups in the early 2000s. And they basically decided, we don't like you as an oligarch. We don't want, we're irritated that you're funding opposition groups. So basically they arrested him. Now, Khodorkovsky was no angel. You know, how he made his wealth in the 90s was not pure as a driven snow. You know, he was involved in tax avoidance, all kinds of, but the motive behind arresting Khodorkovsky and putting him in jail for 10 years was because he was opposing Putin. That's the motive. And then after he was put in jail, I mean, they started making the allegations against him. Some of it was just ludicrous. That was claiming that he was stealing hundreds of thousands of barrels of oil. And, you know, it was just, they were just effectively making up the charges. So you've got that major problem of power, political power, encroaching into the economy, and then you have a massive consolidation of wealth within, not necessarily within oligarchs, but within the people around Putin.
And I think this is something people don't quite understand. And it was quite apparent observing that in the 90s. I taught English to a number of business people, including some Finns who were operating a large state-owned Finnish company in Russia. And of course, I got to hear some incredible stories about how they navigated the bureaucracy, how they navigated this sort of call it semi-legal environment, which all business was conducted in. And you know, that has persisted to an extent. So that system that was chaotic in the 90s and it was used ad hoc by apparatchiks and sort of mid to low level people to sort of, to sort of fleece businesses, that actually then merged with the state apparatus, didn't it? And in essence, you said there's no legal framework, but it's a little more pernicious even than that. And it really ties back to, I think, something you just said there about the inability of sort of middle class to emerge and to be able to conduct business legally. Because it's not that everything was legal or illegal, it's that the law was ambiguous and it had big gaps. And sometimes the law is kept contradictory on purpose. That means you can make a political decision to ignore somebody's business practice, or if politically they get in your way, you can throw the legal book at them. I mean, obviously, they don't bother too much now. They just make nonsense stuff up. But having this sort of chaotic quasi-legal system means that everything is allowed, but nothing is technically legal, which means, you know, you have a system of patronage. You have a system where you can manipulate and control and coerce every business and every business person.
Yes, I mean, the 90s, it was chaos and Yeltsin was drunk half the time, and he could be manipulated and bribed as he was, and somehow they got him re-elected in 1996. And so it was chaotic, and the oligarchs took advantage of that, and assets were sold off by the state for ludicrously low prices. But I think that what changed after Putin came in was, in a sense, the consolidation of wealth was almost institutionalized. I mean, it certainly wasn't chaos. It was almost as if he decided with his cronies, in the Kremlin, that these will operate in the capitalist economy, and we will sell oil and gas abroad, but the actual ownership and the wealth will still be consolidated within a small number of people, a small number of companies. So, I mean, I think that's, in essence, what has happened. That is, there's an old saying that you can't control what you don't own, and you can't own what you don't control. And so I think that's really what's happened. And so it's a problem for any businessman doing business in Russia, because you've got two issues. You've got the fear of your contract or your investment being taken away or undermined by a lawsuit or a criminal investigation against you, not knowing if the judge is going to be objective. And secondly, there's constant sort of political interference. If you say the wrong thing or in any way critical of Putin, then you're subject to an investigation by the prosecutor general. And so it's a very difficult situation, and Russia has survived as an economy purely because they have a lot of, in my opinion, just a lot of oil and gas and natural resources. If they didn't have that, they'd be in serious trouble.
Or they'd have had to build a different system if they weren't reliant on that. And I think it's interesting as well, because we often think, perhaps mistakenly, of oligarchs as business people. We look at even the category down of super wealthy, but there are people who will be creating businesses, generating businesses, and as you say, operating in a framework that is not ideal, not a framework of stable laws, not a framework of a, impartial judiciary. But there's another problem, isn't there? Because the minute you create a successful business, you may get what's called a hostile, aggressive takeover. And it's not necessarily going to be another business person. It could be a so-called apparatchik or one of the Silovikii who basically muscles in and uses this legal ambiguity and corruption to take over your business.
Yeah, quite often businessmen who are critical of the Kremlin or Putin or even just foreign policy. A good example is a Russian businessman called Oleg Tinkov, who is not an oligarch. He's made a lot of money through a whole range of different business interests in technology and food production and a whole range of things. And he, very critical of the Ukraine war. Within 2 months, he was attacking it as crazy and barbaric. And suddenly, as soon as he went public on his Instagram message, he got phone calls from people representing the Kremlin, basically saying, unless you sell your shares for effectively 3% of their real value, you're going to be taken over. So this constant threat of state acquisition and confiscation it looms over anyone who is critical or doesn't make the right move or doesn't make the right connection. And you can't avoid that. I mean, there are Russian billionaires even from the 90s who really made their wealth just through mainly just entrepreneurial long-term investment. I mean, even some of the oligarchs from the 90s, a few of them did it through their own business acumen and had very little to do with Putin. And I think it's important to make that distinction.
But to retain that, and if they want to retain connections with Russia, if any of their businesses in terms of generating income still have reliance in Russia, then they're sucked into this system, aren't they? And what I think is the least easy perhaps to understand is going to be, how does the Kremlin use the business diaspora in places like London to exert influence? Now, I know with the full-blown war in 2022, that mechanism probably is really not working in the way it used to, but sanctions were extremely light after 2014, given the severity of what Russia was doing. Do you think the Kremlin was able to exert influence through the oligarch diaspora in London, through their investments and donations, political parties, their social status, etc.? Were they able to sort of dampen down our reaction in 2014 and delay the full-scale sanctions that we see now?
I think the level of influence from the Kremlin and Putin through London-based oligarchs in terms of political influence, I think that's overstated. I'm not sure that, well, it's very, for the Kremlin and Putin, obviously their foreign policy and their influence in London, in the UK and Washington and Europe is very important to them. And undermining Western democracies is very important to them in influence. But I would say that they're more likely to have done it, and they have done it, certainly historically, they did it through the KGB and more recently through the FSB. And I would say they're more, that. Well, I know that they've done it, they did it more through FSB operations, through their intelligence network in London. I'm not sure, I mean, the oligarchs who have, for example, hired members of the House of Lords to be directors of their companies or donated to the Conservative Party, some of those are anti-Putin. And I'm not quite convinced, unless someone can show me evidence, that, the Putin and the Kremlin have used oligarch money in London to try and lobby the British government, influence the British government. It's quite possible, but I've not really seen evidence of that. And I think that certainly a lot of the Yeltsin 90s oligarchs who parked their money in London, some of them were anti-Putin, and I think that's overstated.
And of course, we had other issues, didn't we, with Russia, perhaps much earlier than, say, Germany and other countries did, with the murder of Alexander Litvinenko, and of course the Skripals afterwards, and there were other lesser profile run-ins with Russia, but certainly our relations soured much earlier. Now, what I'd like to understand is, what was the impact of the murder of Litvinenko and the clear projection of Kremlin power and threat into, what had been a very sort of cozy, decadent kind of lifestyle of oligarchs in London.
Well, I think obviously it poisoned relations between the UK and Putin and the Kremlin after the murder of Litvinenko and later Skripal. It was surprising in a way because, Litvinenko was an opposition activist and he was posting public messages, making very serious allegations against Putin. But it really, it kind of changed everything, really. And then 2008, with the invasion of Georgia, and I think at that time, the relations just completely went back, almost like a Cold War situation. And so I don't know, what will be interesting is that, and other foreign policy specialists can probably address this more than I can, is at what point did Putin decide to suddenly become very aggressive, because by authorizing the assassination of Litvinenko and then later Skripal, what was the catalyst or the event that he suddenly decided to launch this effective, well, more than a Cold War, when you had these assassinations, a hot war in effect. And I don't quite know the answer to that. All I know, given his background, is that he's always privately wanted to restore the Soviet Union. And obviously we're seeing that now with the Ukraine war and their activities in Georgia as well, which I think are quite interesting. And I think that's been the overall strategy. And perhaps the Litvinenko murder was the first stage of that. I'm not sure that has much to do with the oligarchs, although Litvinenko was working for Berezovsky, who was a major critic of Putin. So that could have been a major trigger as well.
Would it send a message, though, to those oligarchs who perhaps hadn't got involved in politics, but perhaps didn't like the way things were going? You've got ones like Khodorkovsky, who's clearly jumped in and gone all in with the opposition politics. You've got Chichvarkin and others. But don't these sort of murders abroad, they send two messages, don't they? One is your money isn't safe necessarily, so enjoy it, but don't be political. And, we may call on you for favours. We may call on you to bring that money back. And I know Putin has tried to get some of that money repatriated, but probably without much success. The other one is a very clear warning not to get involved in politics, not to agitate, not to speak out. And it might persuade some who were contemplating being a bit more active to just literally focus on their so-called business activities instead.
Yes, and I think, the post-Yeltsin oligarchs have really kept out of politics. Alisher Usmanov is a good example. I mean, just, incredibly wealthy, made a lot of money from the 90s, but also later on in the 2000s as well, have really stayed out of politics. Mikhail Friedman's another good example. And so they've heeded the warning based on what happened with Khodorkovsky. But clearly they effectively, the Kremlin decided to really ram it home with the murder of Litvinenko, to say, look, if you get involved in any political activity, we're going to come after you. And that's clearly what's happened. And so I think that message is now crystal clear. And that's what they've always wanted. So I think that's, any Russian businessman or oligarch is obviously not going to do that now.
And of course, that means their efforts are combined to making money and spending money. And let's turn to that aspect of it, because, of course, the other thing when people mention Lundegrad is conspicuous consumption, incredible wealth. They might think of the feuds, in the 90s, if they were in the early 2000s, if they were, reading the papers. But generally, it's about conspicuous consumption, women, private jets, mega yachts, football clubs, probably, you know, the security guards or bouncers that go everywhere with the super rich. Tell me a little bit about how they spend it and how they flaunt this money. Because as you say, they don't invest it typically in charities. They don't reinvest it in education or in infrastructure back in Russia.
Well, the most important thing for the Russian oligarchs is to protect their money, keep it safe. I think there's a Russian word called Krishna, I think it's called, which means roof. And it's having a roof over your assets and your wealth. And that is by the security and Russia, not just Russian oligarchs, Russians generally, is a very important issue. You know, financial security, physical security, even security in your relationships, security anywhere, it's incredibly important. So when they made all their money in the 90s, the oligarchs needed to keep their money secure, keep it safe. And they chose London mainly because of the rule of law. You still have a judiciary in the UK, which is objective and not arbitrary, and that you'll get a fair hearing. But also the regulatory system is weak. It's not aggressive. There's no system here of real accountability and scrutiny and regulation and oversight. And so if you want, so for London, it's perfect for the oligarchs, because the UK authorities have a very light touch on monitoring your activities and your wealth. And so you basically can be effectively left alone. We're in reality, in the early 2000s, we were a soft touch. The British law enforcement agencies and intelligence monitored Russian money coming in, but they didn't really do anything about it. Whereas if they'd moved to Switzerland, particularly the United States or France or even most of Europe, there would be some kind of investigation. It may be long term, but there would have been much more, certainly in the United States, there would have been a lot more oversight and accountability. So London was perfect, and also they enjoyed the lifestyle. So, but it wasn't enough just to put their money in bank accounts. So that's why they started buying up property. And the oligarchs, when they first came to London and in Surrey, sometimes they didn't even look at the houses, and they would pay over the odds. It was just to park the money, keep the money safe. And they paid ridiculous prices for properties in Belgravia and Knightsbridge and Kensington and all the and Highgate, just to keep the money safe, put the money somewhere so that if something went wrong, they've got a haven for it. And obviously, and then they would have their yachts and their private jets, although those more international assets, and they enjoyed the lifestyle. You know, Russians sort of have a romantic view of London, you know, probably based on movies they've watched. And it's a complete contrast to the sort of harsh realities of Russian life. You know, the people are totally different. You know, culturally, you're very hard to get a more diverse contrast between the temperament of an English person and a Russian person, as you know, from living and working in Russia. They speak differently, they think differently, they communicate differently. And it's a total contrast. So I think they were kind of were attracted by that new culture for them, which was so different. And they liked the schools. So money just poured into London. And obviously the lawyers cleaned up, the estate agents, financial advisors, bankers, all made a lot of money from Russian money. And they didn't pay too much attention about where the money had come from. And there was a Channel 4 investigation, undercover investigation by Channel 4, where a Russian journalist pretended to be a Russian state official. And he came to London and went to see all these estate agents in London, basically said, and this is on camera, basically said, I've got £5 million to spend. It's come out of the state budget. It's basically admitting that it was dirty money. And these estate agents, so I'm sure we can get around that or something, you know, the words to the effect. And they're allowed to go around buying property in London with money that had been stolen from the Russian state. And the estate agents didn't, you know, just passed, you know, had a blind eye to it. So I think, you know, there's two issues to that. One, keeping their money safe, and two, the attraction of London as a place to to hide their money.
And the legal system not only provided protections, which they couldn't get within Russia, it also had, as you say, the solicitors and the financial advisors who could create all the shell companies and everything else they might have needed to cover up, you know, in terms of audit trails. But also, I believe that our libel laws were very beneficial in that it has enabled oligarchs to quash many stories about them and control the narratives again up until 2022. But even after that, there are stories about Prigozhin, who's not an oligarch, but actually using our legal system to try and suppress stories about Wagner.
Yes, I mean, a favorite tactic of the Russian oligarchs, whether it's commercially or to suppress any kind of published investigation or criticism or revelation, is basically to give a huge amount of money to a British law firm and say, go after that publication or that journalist or that author and make their life complete hell, and to basically bully and intimidate through relentless, almost like a military style onslaught of litigation threats, even if they know that it probably won't even go into court. It's just that onslaught which they will use some of London's most prestigious law firms to make life hell for anyone that writes or publishes or broadcasts anything critical of those oligarchs. And now, in recent years, it's become even more serious. We've got a ridiculous situation where the head of the Wagner mercenary group was able to file a lawsuit against Bandcamp, which is the investigative website that was critical of the owner of the Wagner group, and they were able to hire a London law firm to do that, and it didn't go anywhere because it was a ridiculous lawsuit and had no substance to it at all. And eventually the lawsuit didn't go anywhere, it was just thrown out, and the London law firm admitted that, you know, they resigned from the account. But it left a law legal costs bill for the owner of Bellingcat. I think it's probably about £75,000. So it just, the effect of all this in reality is that it makes, either maybe subconsciously or consciously, a journalist or investigator or whoever it is, think twice about publishing material about oligarchs or the Russian state or whoever, because they know the British legal system is the onus is on the defendant to prove the case for the publisher or the newspaper journalist to prove, but it gets caught up in this litigation, which is extremely expensive and stressful, and so they end up sometimes just not going ahead.
And that makes media owners, I think, also think twice about that. So I think there's a famous case in there where Catherine Belton was sued, and the publication she was working for decided to nonetheless sort of go ahead with the articles that she was producing. I think eventually they won. Elliot Higgins, obviously, another case there where he came out on top, but lost a lot of money into the process. From your experience of working with multiple newspapers, what is the challenge of an editor there who perhaps wants to run with the story but fears this kind of onslaught of litigation?
Well, I think a lot of editors, some editors rather, are very nervous and scared, and publishers as well, of publishing stories, even if they know the story is true and even if they have evidence, because they're not prepared to have to spend hundreds of thousands of pounds on legal costs just defending themselves, even if they win. So it's a form of, they may get involved in a certain amount of self-censorship, and it just makes them think twice. It makes them more cautious. It inhibits their reporting and publication, because litigation is so expensive, and it's very stressful and it's time consuming. So they're less likely to go ahead, because the British legal system and the British libel system anyway is so much in favor of the accuser, the plaintiff, i.e. the oligarch, than it is the defendant, which is the newspaper or the journalist.
Now, another victim of Putin's sort of high-profile, how should we put them, revenge attacks, or however you want to label them, is a story that I'm actually not that familiar with, and I think many listeners to the channel won't know the ins and outs of, and that is Stephen Curtis, who died in a helicopter crash. In fact, a crash that he himself had predicted was likely to happen because of his work as lawyer to many of Britain's richest Russian oligarchs. So could you tell me a bit about that story and why he perhaps was the victim of a Russian hit?
Well, in my book, London Grad, I write quite a lot about this lawyer, Stephen Curtis, who was the lawyer for Berezovsky and Khodorkovsky and other Russians in London. And he was the go-to lawyer if you were a Russian oligarch or businessman. You wanted to move your assets and wealth to London and hide them offshore. Curtis was one of the main lawyers to go to. And he was an intellectually brilliant man. He couldn't use a computer. He never sent an email, but he had like a photographic memory. And he could remember account numbers of offshore bank accounts. And he was just a brilliant lawyer for you to oversee, protect your money. So what happened was that Khodorkovsky and Yukos Oil hired him to restructure their overseas corporate empire and set up a lot of offshore companies to protect it from any attempt by the Kremlin or the Russian state to in some way nationalize it, or and even in private litigation. And so Curtis was brilliant at doing that. And what happened was that Curtis became so successful, and he had this office on Park Lane in Mayfair, and that he then himself was getting very nervous about his Russian clients. So he'd start sending reports to, which was then the National Criminal Intelligence Service, which was basically the arm of Scotland Yard investigating financial crime and organized crime in London. And he started sending what they call self-reporting documents about what he was doing because he was nervous. And then he started getting scared that he was in too deep with these Russians, and he became a registered informant to Scotland Yard on Russian organized crime in London. And but at the same time, he quite enjoyed the thrills and spills of the job, and he started almost behaving like a Russian oligarch. He started wearing every leather jackets and going to nightclubs and having huge amounts of cash in his office. And so he was caught between representing oligarchs, but also secretly very nervous and being an informant for Scotland Yard. And then about 6 weeks after he became a registered informant for the British police, he died in this helicopter crash. Now, there's been a lot of speculation about whether he was murdered. Helicopters are notoriously unsafe. It's not unusual for people to die in helicopter crashes. The investigation didn't reveal any clear evidence of foul play or any kind of murder. But Curtis, I know for a fact, did predict that he would die in such a way before he died. I mean, I interviewed people who knew him, and he certainly received death threats before his death, partly as much by commercial competitors. So there were people who certainly wanted him dead, including the Kremlin, because at that time he was working for Khodorkovsky. You have to remember, when Curtis died in March 2004, it was about a year or 8 months after his client Khodorkovsky was arrested. So Curtis then became more involved in the whole Khodorkovsky business empire. So he was more than a lawyer; he was actually an executive in the business. So certainly the Kremlin and the Russian state would have regarded him as an enemy at that time. But at the same time, there's no real evidence that he was murdered.
And of course, there are many bankers as well who mysteriously die out jogging. And even Berezovsky himself died in quite mysterious sort of circumstances. So this sort of intrigue and doubt is going to cling over everybody, I think, involved with Russian oligarchs. Well, I've got sort of two more questions, and I think they're rather more sort of forward-looking than sort of looking back, because, of course, a lot has changed since February 2022. And the first question is going to be about the opposition. As Putin becomes ever more extreme and repressive at home, and as not just oligarchs, but the Russian diaspora who are able to get money out of the country, that's much more tough in London these days. But is London now becoming much more a centre for Russian opposition? Or is that really much more centred closer to Russia's borders in, say, Eastern Europe, the Baltics, and so on?
I would say the Russian opposition, despite the murders of Litvinenko and others, I still feel safer in London. I think they have more political support. Again, they'll have more support from the courts and any judges in terms of, you know, you have to remember that, although this goes back to the oligarchs rather than the opposition, no Russian oligarch has been extradited from London back to Russia, despite huge attempts by the Kremlin. And the reason for that is that the British judges, quite rightly, have to rule that there's no rule of law in Russia. If you were extradited back to Russia, it's usually, not always, on a politically motivated extradition warrant, and you're just going to get thrown in jail, and you know you're not going to get a fair trial. So if you believe in the rule of law, then you can't extradite them. So I think they feel safe here. I think so. The opposition will either be in London or they'll be in Israel. And in Israel, if you're Jewish or you have Israeli citizenship, you will never be extradited from Israel. As you know, it will never happen. So you're very safe in Israel, and I think you're relatively safe in London. I think they feel less safe, and they'll definitely feel less safe in the Baltic states and in Eastern Europe. And to some extent, they'll be safe in America. You know, Garry Kasparov, the former world chess champion and a major opposition activist, he lives in New York, and I think they feel safe there as well.
And it's not always the case. I remember speaking to Bill Browder and various Interpol warrants out for his arrest to take him to Russia. And actually, that came quite close to happening while he was in Spain, of all places. And apparently because of a connection between someone in the royal family and Russian oligarchs. So this idea of sort of arbitrary justice and falling into the Kremlin's hands must be a fear that preys on a lot of both opposition and oligarch minds.
Yes, I mean, I think you have to be very careful if you're going to hide somewhere, or you're going to go into exile, or move about where you go. I mean, Spain have had their corruption issues. The former king being an obvious example, Juan Carlos, his relationship with Saudi Arabia. And you know, you know, I think that they just have a different, legal system in other countries, and it's not as secure as it is in London, and that's why they're here. And so, I think if you're a smart opposition activist, you're going to go to London, or if you're Jewish, you're going to go to Israel, and I think there are obviously other countries. The United States, but I would say the United States are more vulnerable to being with further in terms of lobbying, and that's why they stay in London.
Absolutely, and slightly more extreme elements of the GOP, not the majority by any means, but there are extreme elements there which are saying some things which do strongly align with Kremlin propaganda. The last question, I think, is again going to be a forward-looking one, and that is, London grad enabled oligarchs to take their money out of Russia, keep it safe here, and it provided no incentive at all for them to work on improving Russia, improving its political environment, on generating a functioning economy, rule of law, middle class, civil society. It completely short-circuited any mechanism that would have forced people to face up to the issues in Russia. Now, with the war going on, oligarchs are sanctioned. And there's two things, I think, which I'd be interested to hear your opinion on, which really should emerge from our newfound moral position vis-a-vis Ukraine. And that is, how can we use oligarch money and Russian money that has been sanctioned to help build Ukraine, rebuild Ukraine? And the other one, of course, is how can we prevent Londongrad from happening again? Because even though Russian oligarchs are sanctioned, that entire mechanism is still in place for oligarchs from China, Africa, or wherever. I mean, we haven't dismantled that system that was so cozy for the Russian oligarchs. It's only they who've been excluded. Other rich businessmen are quite able to use and subvert the sort of relatively safe legal framework that we've got here.
Well, the answer to your first question is, I think we have to be incredibly careful about how sanctions policy, how sanctions are enforced or implemented. And I think I've actually got a serious problem with the way the sanctions have been implemented. I understand they had to move quickly, but we are opposing Putin and we're supporting Ukraine because he has breached international law. He's invaded an independent country. Putin and his and the Kremlin have committed authorized horrific war crimes. There's multiple criminal offenses that they have conducted, and it's an absolutely horrendous, evil thing that they've done, and totally illegal. So the problem is that if we sanction wealthy Russians and freeze their assets, we have to do it in a proper legal way. And the way it's been done, unfortunately, has not been done in that legal way. First of all, when you're sanctioned, your assets are frozen, but that doesn't mean that you can still own your assets. That money, your house, your bank accounts, it's frozen. It's not actually being used by the state for the Ukraine army or military or air force. And so the problem is that the some of the of the oligarchs and some of the wealthy Russians, their assets have been frozen not on a very clear criteria. Basically, the ministers decide on the recommendation of civil servants and probably the intelligence agencies which oligarchs should be sanctioned. And the way it's been done is that quite a few have been sanctioned, even opposition activists. I mentioned earlier a man called Oleg Tinkov. He's been sanctioned, and he's one of the most aggressive, vociferous opponents of the war. So they've been sanctioning all kinds of people, and there's been no real rule of, there's not been any due process legally for them to challenge it. And the problem with that politically is that it enables Putin to say, well, look, they're sanctioning Russian people with no legal recourse. And secondly, sanctioning, okay, what's the purpose of it is to put pressure on Putin. But a lot of those oligarchs, they're not in a position to go and talk to Putin and say, my money's being sanctioned and frozen, pull off the war. I mean, that's just crazy and naive, to say the least. And so politically, it looks good to sanction oligarchs, and some of the oligarchs deserve to be sanctioned. But I think there's a real issue there. And in terms of using the money to help the Ukraine defense, they're not in a position to do so, because then you'd have to confiscate and take ownership of those assets. And we're not at that stage. Sanctions basically means you're freezing their assets, but it doesn't mean to say that the British government has actual access to that money. So we're in limbo land. And so I hope that makes sense. But I've issues with the sanctions. I don't think it's been done very well, which I wrote about recently in the Spectator. Your second question about whether London grad will come back. I think that's what your question was. I don't think it can. I think the British government, the history of the United Kingdom is that we don't have revolutions, but we learn and we evolve and we have reforms and we learn from various situations. And then we make reforms to make sure they don't happen again. And I think that's what's going to happen with London grad. I think the only good thing out of all this is that British judiciary, the regulators, the police, the enforcement agencies will have learned that you can't allow London to become a haven for dirty money and foreign money. Because not just, there's plenty of foreign dirty money. It's not just Russia. All over the world, there's plenty of corrupt money hidden in London. It's not just Russia. And so I think hopefully after the end of the war, perhaps they'll introduce some reform to make sure it doesn't happen again.
And of course, Britain doesn't just control London. No, we have influence about what happens in many other territories around the world. And if we really had the political will to drive a sort of more, let's say, morally driven financial system, we would have some clout, wouldn't we, to help evolve such a framework?
Yeah, I mean, I think Britain still has enough influence to go to certain countries where, again, it's the, I keep coming back to the issue of the lack of the rule of law to ensure that things are done properly and to influence those governments on where there is huge corruption. And then it still exists all over the world, not just Russia, Nigeria being an obvious example, where there's just, it's almost cultural, it's almost institutionalized, and all over the world where, you know, the wealth of the country is basically stolen, where the actual people who generate the wealth, the working people who actually make the money, who produce the mine, the, you know, in terms of natural resources and through the mines and through factories and through manufacturing and through generating oil and refining oil and all the actual work, the benefits of that work is basically take is largely taken over by the owners of that business. And that's, in one sense, there's nothing wrong with that, but it's become so extreme in terms of how they rip off, national, you know, state-owned wealth, and are allowed to become incredibly rich. And we live in a world, unfortunately, where the very rich are getting richer, and the poor are getting poorer, and it's almost as if we've gone backwards to the 1930s.
Well, Mark, that's been absolutely fascinating. And I think there are so many things there which we could carry on sort of tugging at the threads for hours and exploring them. But I think the time is up for our conversation on this. However, I do recommend people check out your books. London Grad is an absolutely fascinating read. We'll put the links to that in this video. And of course, in a couple of months, we'll get the chance to talk about your new book when it's published. And that is A History of the KGB. Is that the KGB in Russia itself, or is that their foreign operations?
It's their foreign operations.
Well, I very much look forward to
that. In the UK and the US.
Fantastic. Well, I look forward to that. And we'll post a warning when that is imminent as well. But thank you so much for your time today, Mark, and for exploring the theme of London Grad with us.
Thank you.